All right, guys, welcome to another Land and Legacy podcast. I'm your host, Adam Keith.
And Matt Dye.
And we are here in Columbia, Missouri, at the Pheasants Forever, Quail Forever State
Chapter
Banquet meeting. And we are here, we presented this morning.
Yep.
And we discussed, what was the title of our thing again?
Habitat Management, or, Conserving Habitat for the Betterment of Hunting Heritage? Something like that. It was a long title. We didn't come up with it.
No, they pretty much kind of, we told them so what we could talk about, and they said, yeah, let's do that one and call it this. And so we presented on ways to basically bring more people into the outdoors. And so,
and not just through hunting.
And we kind of focused on not so much hunting, but ways to bring other family members and other people into the outdoors through other activities rather than hunting, and through other conversations rather than hunting. So we talked about the different groups of people: environmentalists, naturalists, hunters, farmers, gardeners,
preservationists,
and how instead of just when we go to a landscape and we say, "Oh yeah, I'm hunting it. Yeah, I'm kind of planting some food plots and trying to make it better for my hunting."
Basically, take mentality.
We say, oh, we're going and we're planting some native grasses or a pollinator blend, or we're doing prescribed fire, and that's all just to improve the land. And
which all those people, though, can relate to and find common ground on.
Yes.
Whether
that's
it's
right.
Environmentalist, preservationist, you know, restoring and looking at the natural land use, people can get on board with that. Unless,
sure,
you know, you're just coming at it from the eyes of, I'm just here as a hunter just to keep.
I'm just trying to grow big deer. So
yeah, we can reach more people like that.
And so he doesn't have to sit in silence anymore. We have returning, we might as well call you co-host.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
Welcome back, baby.
Yeah. Frank Longcarriage from Missouri Department of Conservation.
Oh, thanks, guys. Thanks. Yeah. I enjoyed visiting with you guys today. We've had some in-depth discussions.
For sure.
And it's been great.
And yeah, you were presenting today.
Yep. Yep.
Same time we were, so we didn't get to hear each other
speak.
Yeah,
that was an unfortunate kind of artifact of the schedule.
Basically, they just wanted to get the best out there first.
We let off the conference and in style, and
we had I saw people in the hallways like they were going 2 foot this way and then going back, and they're like predators.
Yeah, they just couldn't decide. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, I don't blame them, right?
They actually had the game where they take the solo cup and put a string in it and run it from room to room. They could listen and talk.
Telephone game.
They were doing that with the presentations. Yep. It was wild out here.
Yeah.
So, give us a little bit of a idea what your presentation was.
So, in previous podcasts, whether it was me or Kyle, we talked about our quail research that we've done in the southwest part of Missouri. So there are several different aspects of that quail research. And the one that I talked about today was a predator component that we initiated.
Yes.
And basically we've got, and kind of a review again, we've got two different landscape types that we're working on. So we've got open grassland sites. That we've got traditional sites that are more farm agricultural based, right? And so one of our hypotheses were that predators and the predator context was different on grasslands versus on these traditional sites. Were there more predators on these traditional sites or less? And then how did they use the landscape? How did they travel through these different habitat types? And that has a big impact on these predators' ability to find quail or their nests. So those are the two things we wanted to look at, is what was the predator density and abundance on these two landscape types, and how did they utilize their landscape? How did they hunt? So I talked about that, and what we found was very interesting. On the grassland sites, there were fewer predators, which makes sense because there's less predator habitat. And predators, we're talking raccoons and possums and things like that. There were less predators. And also, they spent less time on these grasslands than they did in other habitat types. So on our traditional sites, we had more predators, and they spent a relative amount, they relatively spent more time on these traditional sites. And the reasons for that is these predators, these raccoons and these possums, they have predators too, right? And that's usually coyotes or bobcats. And so they need protection from these predators. And their main source of protection are tall trees. So on these grassland landscapes, there's less tall trees. And so there's more opportunity for coyotes and bobcats to depredate raccoons and possums and skunks than there is on the traditional sites. All right, so we talked about that. So what we found is raccoons were up to 3 times more likely to travel within an area where a quail nest might be found on traditionally managed lands versus on grasslands.
3 times as much?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yep. So
as you're throwing that out there, I can't help but think of the Southeast. Mm-hmm. You know, big quail plantations, Georgia, and you look at those, and a lot of them are like that longleaf restoration, mm-hmm. scattered pine, great understory. What do you think in that realm, you know, what's the suggestion there from a predator standpoint? Because, again, there's a native landscape that's longleaf pine. How does that all come together?
You know, that's an interesting question. Because they do have very high quail densities on those mm-hmm. landscapes.
Mm-hmm. And one thing interesting to note, let's say South Carolina, where a coyote isn't native to that area, mm-hmm. and that's the huge, mm-hmm. people really hate coyotes mm-hmm. down there. But at the same time, they had red wolves, which was the native predator, one of the big predators up there. And mm-hmm. I've had that debate with people where they're like, there is no native predators here.
Yeah.
But they forget about the red wolves. So I wanted to mention that before we went into that.
Yeah. I will say this. We're at a show, so there's background noise.
Yeah.
So if you hear that.
Looks like they're getting lunch or dinner ready probably.
I like that.
Yeah,
so.
Right on.
Don't hate us too bad.
Breakfast cool or tomorrow, deal. They say. So, yep.
Wish I was hanging around.
Yeah. So in the Southeast, where they have these forested or these savanna or woodland landscapes, where there's a lot of trees, you know, there's going to be high incidence of predation rates from raccoons or small mammals, or there's going to be more opportunities for these predators to hunt because they have a lot of trees that they can hunt from or they can escape to.
Yeah.
But the key there is there are plantation after plantation after plantation. There are vast landscapes, right? So mm-hmm. we're dealing with a large landscape that can and tons and tons of usable space, and then quail can overcome that level of predation where they can't more in the Midwest, where we have fragmented landscapes and we're dealing with small management units, where a predation event can have a significant impact on your local population.
I think
it's just a numbers game.
A couple things that come to mind for me is in those landscapes of the Southeast. Yeah, there may be scattered longleaf pines or even loblolly pines, savannas or mm-hmm. woodlands. Still, the understory has a ton of vegetation, if it's managed correctly, mm-hmm. to where there's plenty of cover throughout that entire landscape,
sure. yeah.
to where it's not confined to certain areas.
Yep.
Like, if you look at prairies, a lot of the areas where the trees, the fence rows are going, there's not a whole lot of dense cover underneath those mm-hmm. as well.
Yep.
And it may be the only woody section to where they're trying to nest close or whatever. Another thing to note, and I'm almost forgetting this because of my mind's already going to the next question, but
I got the next question in my head.
I forgot what it was.
Oh,
let's
gosh.
Just go on.
Okay, so let me expound on that a little bit. In the Southeast, you're right. There's tons of herbaceous cover under this canopy of loblolly pine or mm-hmm. longleaf pine, whatever the overstory is. There's tons of herbaceous cover. So there's good protection there. But predators are still a problem. And not mm-hmm. And not only are we talking about the mammal predators that we traditionally think of, like raccoons or possums or skunks.
I remembered it.
Armadillos are a problem now down there, but also snakes.
Armadillos are a problem for the quail down
yeah,
there.
Yeah, for predating nests, yeah.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. Snakes are a big one.
Right? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Snakes are a big one. They're ubiquitous across the landscape. They love to eat eggs.
Oh, yeah.
And, but But what they found there is that these presences of these really thick hardwood drain areas or these really thick draws that have a lot of woody understory in it, that's where most of the snakes are going to hang out because they tend to be aerial hunters in a lot of cases, black rat snakes and whatnot.
Yeah, yeah.
So the removal of those hardwood drains or those thickets of hardwoods down there means there's probably less snakes, and so you're probably going to get less snake predation. But they do in the Southeast, they worry about predators, and predators do have an impact on their population, there's no doubt. And down there, quail hunting is big money. I mean, that's what drives those plantations. That's why the Red Hills in Georgia and Florida are still there in an intact landscape, is precisely because of the bobwhite quail. And so they do a lot of things.
There's a lot riding on it.
Yes, absolutely.
Huge resource.
Yes. And they do a lot of things with respect to predation management that most places can't do from a time perspective, a money perspective, an expense, or even a, say, political perspective, because they're trapping predators at times when it may not be politically acceptable for us as a state agency to trap predators.
Sure.
So predation is a big thing, and I don't want to minimize it, and they really look at it. But the vastness of that landscape and that key aspect of their huge areas of usable space is what's driving that population to be as good as it is.
Hmm. What about aerial predators? I mean, we're not talking about management of that. I'm just saying, like, throw out some predators, examples that a lot of people may overlook from a quail standpoint.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's not really one aerial predator that specializes on quail.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of aerial predators that will take quail. And the ones that we worry about most are what we call the accipiters. So sharp-shin hawks, Cooper's hawks, and then in the north, you got goshawks, things like that. Those are the guys that tend to hunt low to the ground. They hunt birds a lot. They're super fast.
They're streamlined bodies.
Streamlined. They're like jets. Some people, when they talk
real
about...
hard to hit with a shot.
No, yeah.
I'm kidding.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I would never do that. Never shot one, but...
But I imagine they're very hard to hit with a shotgun, right?
Yeah.
So when people talk about them, they kind of equate them to the jet fighters, right? Mm-hmm. They're swooping around through the understory.
Yeah.
They're the ones we worry about the most. Then there's the predators or the raptors that are called buteos or the red-tailed hawks.
They're
red
shoulder
hawks.
Stockier,
yep. Larger, stockier.
Broader shoulder.
Yep, broader shoulder. We see a lot of those. You'll see a lot of those perched on telephone poles or fence poles. They tend to hunt from a perching standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
So they'll perch, scan around, look for their food, and go after it. People kind of talk about them as the bombers or the big slow-flying bombers, right, if you're thinking about airplanes. They will take quail. I had an incident in Kansas where I was tracking quail one time, and I was driving down the road, and this red-tailed hawk jumped up out of the ditch and dropped a fresh quail right in front of me in the road, just right in front of me. I thought, well, that's weird. I obviously had disturbed it right after it caught its prey, and then it took off. Well, when I went to pick it up, it was one of my banded birds that I
had. No kidding.
Yeah, so I was able to get a band recovery on that, which was cool.
You couldn't resuscitate?
No, he was done. He was done. So they can be quail predators. They're not as important quail predators as the accipiters.
Not as much of a primary food source.
Right, they're not as much as, and there's not a, they're not as much of a danger to quail.
Mm-hmm.
Another story I'll relate on these accipiters are these sharp shin and Cooper's hawks. I was, same project in Kansas. I was tracking covey quail in a CRP field. I got too close and bumped them. The quail took off. And there was a tree row to my left. Now the corner of my eye, I saw a hawk coming. And it had seen that covey quail flush, and it nailed one right in front of me out of the air, just rolled it up. Yeah, it was a really cool display of nature at work.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was really cool. Something I would have never seen if I hadn't been out there doing it. It happened to be one of my radio birds, but it was pretty cool to see this predation event happen. And it really drove home how effective that these predators can be when they spot quail.
Yeah.
They can be really, really effective at catching them.
And everyone knows how quickly quail can flush.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, like, that's impressive in and of itself.
Yep. Yeah.
But then for them to be captured, caught in that moment.
Yep. In the air. Yeah.
Wild. Yeah. Wild. It doesn't show the, you know, extreme nature of those birds.
Yeah. So those are the ones we really think about as being quail predators from the air.
Right. So when we're talking predators, this is one thing, and I sent some research to you that I stumbled upon. There's a lot of predators to a bobwhite quail that you can't manage.
Yes. Right.
As far as the type of management we traditionally think of, trapping, shooting, removal.
Mm-hmm.
By
physical means.
Physical means, yes. So like coyotes, raccoons, possums, skunks, those all come to mind because we can trap them or shoot them.
Right.
But when it comes to raptors, we can't do anything about it. Mm-hmm. Legally, when it comes to snakes, we can't do anything about it.
Right.
Would you care to talk a little bit about that on how to manage for predators? I guess that's where this podcast is headed, but talking about how to manage predators that you can't physically remove.
Yeah. So let's talk about raptors first. Raptors tend to the buteos, the ones that we talk about, even accipiters, the sharp shins and the Cooper's hawks, they start hunting from trees, right? So they can scan their environment. That's what happened to that Cooper's hawk that caught the quail I was talking about. It was in a tree scanning the environment. When that covey took off, it launched from that tree. So when we're talking about quail habitat management on public land that I manage, or some of the recommendations I would give to landowners here in the Midwest where I work, is if you've got any tall trees that absolutely don't need to be there, that's one thing you can do is get rid of them and you eliminate that perch. So they don't have a place from which they can hunt. So get rid of those. And that also has a profound impact on raccoons too.
Right.
Getting rid of those. Also having these, and we talked about the importance of shrubby habitat in the last podcast was critical for quail. They absolutely have to have it. And that is a vital protection from predators. When they get flushed by hawks and they are seeking protection, most of the time they dive for the nearest shrubby cover that they can find and get there as fast as they can. Once they're there, they're safe. These hawks can't dive through a plum thicket or a gray dogwood thicket and grab a quail.
But being in Oklahoma and looking at those plum thickets, they're designed perfectly as escape cover.
Yep.
What do you escape cover with the little canopy that they have and the way they grow and tangle up it together?
Oh yeah,
it's bigger at the top, skinnier at the bottom.
It's like an umbrella.
Yes, that's a great point. It's like an umbrella.
Wiry umbrella.
Umbrella plants, like ragweed umbrella plant.
Yeah, and broomweed's the same way.
Mm. Yep. One that comes to mind, it's something I always bring into the podcast. We've talked about this a lot because we're in Oklahoma, but eastern red cedar has been talked about a lot lately. Mm-hmm. It's the exact opposite.
It's a conical shape.
Yes.
Yeah. It's like upside down umbrella. Oh, let's make it really thick at the bottom and it gets shorter at the top. Like it doesn't, it's not something ideal for
wildlife to get underneath as a protection.
Yeah.
Especially
there's
no space.
Especially when you put it out in a grassland, it gets really bushy at the base.
Mm-hmm.
Now you could send a fire through there and try to kill it and burn out the bottom branches.
Right.
But it's not ideal. It's not the umbrella effect.
No, it's not. It would be way down on the list for something I would want to have for quail as escape cover.
Didn't pay him to say that either.
Yeah, yeah. It's in an emergency maybe, but these umbrella type shrubs like you're talking about are critically important, not only for thermal cover because it gets super hot in the summertime on these grasslands. They need that thermal cover.
Great point. Great point. Shading.
Yes. Yes.
Everyone thinks of thermal cover from the opposite end, from a deer's aspect. They're thermal for wintertime, retaining heat, keeping in heat from maybe the day.
Yep.
This is thermal cover in the summer. So that in like sumac groves, same thing.
Yep. Sumac groves, plum thickets are great, but any kind of shrubby cover that's low growing, that has that umbrella effect, that typically is like that colony type forming plant.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've done some work where we've taken anecdotally kind of on field days and whatnot, we'll put thermometers in those shrubby thickets and then out on the grasslands. And you'll see a 20 to 30 degree difference in these thickets. And that's significant on a 100-degree day for a quail.
Whew, you ain't kidding.
You know, so they can hide, they can scoot in there. They're not expending energy, thermal regulating. It's much cooler. It's important. And one of the things that's interesting is, you know, we think of, and I guess I'm going back to the importance of this thermal protection is, you know, we think of a species like the prairie chicken, whether greater or lesser prairie chicken, as being a wide open grassland species that don't need trees, which you absolutely don't. Or, you know, we don't even think about shrubby cover, but they will absolutely use shrubs as thermal cover in the winter, or excuse me, in the summertime. We found a number of greater prairie chickens, whether hens that are be brooding or just individual adults that are in thickets of shrubs for the shading. So these shrubs on these grasslands are super important, not only for quail, but a lot of species, not only for protection from predators, but from thermal conditions that may be, you know, not optimal.
Will you talk about the grasslands in the wintertime and some of the thermal regulation that they have from a quail's aspect? Basically, do the opposite. What are they looking for necessarily in a cooler winter day?
In the what we see is quail kind of, you know, in the winter, whether it's really cold or even if it's not too terribly cold, but it's, you know, wintertime conditions, they spend a fair amount of time out in the open feeding. That's where they're foraging. And then, you know, in the mid-afternoon or mid-morning through mid-afternoon, they're usually in some kind of shrubby cover. And there's some thermal protection from there for sure because it blocks the wind. And so they're going to get a few degrees probably warmer in there, but it blocks the wind, which is a big thing. There's, you know, probably less snow under there too.
It's funny you say that. I'm going through rereading the Sand County Almanac, and you probably read that book as well. I remember there was a part I just went through where he was talking about the effect of wind on birds and how not a lot of people, I think he says something like not many journals write about it because they're probably written in the comfort of a fern, of a fire, by the comfort of a fire. So you're not thinking about the wind, but wind is a crucial thing during the winter months to get out of.
Yeah. And you see that with lots of game birds. I mean, pheasants, they're trying when it's windy on the plains, you know, your best hunting strategy is to find these lee areas away from the wind, whether you're hunting prairie grouse, even if it's not in the cold wind, a windy day, even in September and October, these birds are going to try to get out of that wind. So they're going to be on the lee side of it. But particularly in the winter, pheasants are notorious for getting in areas where it's blocking the wind. Quail are the same ways. So protection from wind is important. Yep.
What kind of species or what do you typically see on windy days quail or pheasants using to get out of the wind?
Well, it's going to be your shrubby cover for the most part. Okay. Pheasants will use shrubby cover to get away from wind where they have it, but a lot of pheasant country doesn't have it. So they get down into real thick patches of CRP grass, so tall switchgrass, Indian grass, big blue stem, or
red
kochia.
Canary.
Or cattails, you know, and especially getting the prairie pottle
region.
What
did you say?
I said Reed's canary.
Okay.
Yeah, super invasive, but pheasants will use it for thermal protection from wind. Kochia is another plant. It kind of grows where there's been some disturbance. It's a really tall plant that kind of grows in the western.
That's the reddish, right? Or what is the red dogwood, the red-stemmed? I thought it was a...
Well, kochia is not a shrub.
I was trying to think. I had a guy tell me a species he had planted in his yard was like red kochia dogwood or
red osier dogwood.
He called it kochia, and I'm like, I don't think that's right.
Yeah,
but I'm gonna have to go back, and I haven't had enough time to look.
Yeah,
that back
it's
up.
Red osier dogwood.
Yeah.
Another good shrub. For quail. Yeah.
Gotcha. Yeah. Have you ever done the thermometer difference on, like, summer day? You said in summer days you've been in shrubs. What about winter days?
I haven't really done it in the wintertime. I'm sure there's some differences. It's going to be warmer in there because it's going to be out of the wind, so the wind chill is going to be reduced.
Yeah. You're trying to find something out of the wind in the sun if there is sunshine.
Yes, that's a good point. So if it's on the south side of a draw – for instance, where it's getting or south or west side of a draw where it's getting some good sunlight. Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit warmer.
Yep.
You know, those are key. Those are key for wintertime protection. Yeah,
I think that's a good point for us. You do so much work with game birds. We do most of our work with deer, but that's a constant educational conflict, let's call it, of eastern red cedar and thermal cover. You guys, you're understanding it from looking at it from temperature-wise, needing sun, survival of a species that's very critical, can have high death rates.
Yep.
Deer, you know, up in the northern states, high winter kill, possibly, depending on the winter. But for the most part, it's not nearly as high as a northern bobwhite quail.
Right.
A lot of people say thermal cover, the best thermal cover for deer is cedar trees. For winter thermal.
Okay.
And so dissecting what Yuga said, we need sunlight so it warms up quicker, but also good wind breaks. A lot of these cedar thickets are wide open. So sure, they may be wide open underneath, like the bottom 2 feet where the deer is actually bedded down. The wind might not blow through there, but at the same time, yesterday we were in a cedar tree monoculture cutting out some pockets, and the ground was still frozen underneath it.
Yeah.
While you walk out 50 yards away from it, and it's thawing out, it's 20 degrees warmer, it felt like.
The only time, as in a thermal cover situation, that a deer would prefer an evergreen like that is honestly at night, because sometimes the cedars or a evergreen would hold in some heat from the day longer than, you know, an open grassland or a prairie. And if the structure's there, they will get underneath. But that's so temporary.
Or snowpack.
That's a very small
debate.
Window percentage.
But I want to hear you talk about snowpack for game birds. But the other side of that is, too, we don't necessarily say evergreens are bad.
No.
Eastern red cedar monocultures are bad for habitat, true habitat. They're not beneficial to quail or a lot of other species.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, you can plant. We recommend planting thermal pockets in northern states where winter
We've been on many properties where we're planting that.
But we're not recommending eastern red cedar. There's other options.
Right.
Way north, white cedar is actually a forage as well. But whatever.
Yeah.
It's a fight that we'll probably fight till the end of our
lives. Right. And there are debates in probably every discipline. There are debates in the game bird world about stuff. You know, we're just going to see that. And
let's hear some of them.
Okay, so
crack open that can.
Okay, so let's talk about you talked about wintertime effects, snowpack.
Yeah.
You mentioned that. And so with quail, if you think about it, in some form, bobwhite quail exist from Central America all the way up to northern Iowa, right? Sometimes into Wisconsin. So that's a huge latitudinal range of bobwhite. So they obviously can persist in subtropical environments. They can persist in arid grasslands. They can persist in moist, you know, deciduous hardwood landscapes if there's enough herbaceous cover on the ground. And they can persist, you know, higher up in the almost to the northern plains if weather conditions are right. But that's the key with these northern populations is weather conditions can really knock your quail back. So a series of warm winters and good reproductive habitat and good reproductive conditions, you can see quail really respond on these northern latitudes and really have good numbers. But it only takes 2 or 3 bad winters to knock
just
that population
right back
down.
Mm-hmm.
And so where we work, we don't have to really worry, at least in the south part of Missouri, we don't worry too much about winter problems because we don't get snow that stays on very long and we don't get ice that stays on very long. But there's some disagreements in how best to manage bobwhite. Some people, like Kyle and I, talk about the focus should be on nesting cover first, providing that usable nesting cover space, and then having that shrubby cover as a component of that.
Mm-hmm.
Other people in the north say, no, we need to focus on shrubby cover first and winter food because we got to have these populations persist through a winter. So let's put some food plots out. Let's really focus on hardcore woody cover, because if we don't have birds survive the winter, you know, what good is our nesting condition? So there's these debates on how best to manage quail, and I don't know that either one is more right than the other. It's just that it depends on where you're at.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, there's no absolutes, right?
It
depends on where you're at. So the way we would manage quail in northeast Nebraska will be different than how I manage quail in southeast Missouri.
Mm-hmm.
The fundamentals will be the same: usable nesting cover, some bare ground for brood, and shrub cover. But do I throw in food plots in north Nebraska? Maybe. Do I do it in southwest Missouri? Probably not, or maybe not, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So there are some of those debates that are going on. There's always the debate on predator control in the game bird world.
Supplemental
feeding is a big one. So
mm-hmm.
let's talk about the southeast. How those plantations achieve these densities of 3 birds per acre, 2.5 birds per acre. Those are super high densities of quail. And how they achieve those is first with the excellent habitat over a large scale, but also they do what are called plus practices. So practices such as supplemental feeding. They're spreading supplemental feed throughout the landscape. They're not only doing it in the winter. It's typically Milo that they're spreading. They're spreading Milo not just have feeders where quail can come. They have feed lanes that are cut throughout their plantation, and they drive these feed lanes, and they spread Milo.
Like with a seed spreader.
Yep, out of a big hopper, and they spread it, broadcast it throughout the landscape. So they do that. They don't, you know, we think, well, that may be something that needs to be done in the wintertime, but they're doing it throughout the spring to get these birds pumped up for nesting, get them in the best condition possible for nesting. So they're doing this supplemental feeding a big part of the year in these plantations. They're doing it some in Texas too. Another thing that's a big debate is predator control. Predator control is big in the southeast, starting to become a popular thing to do in places like Texas, big ranches like that. Totally dismissed in the Midwest as a viable option.
What's your thoughts?
My thoughts.
And I say this because I know you're a trapper.
Yep.
At the same time, you're a pretty big habitat guy.
Mm-hmm.
So my thoughts have always been, I think habitat is the biggest problem, not necessarily the coyote. And in fact, there's some research that shows that coyotes help, or not necessarily a predator to a bobwhite quail, but more a predator to a raccoon who may more specifically be a nest.
Predators kill other predators.
Yeah.
Raccoons are definitely afraid of coyotes because coyotes will kill them. Coyotes will prey on raccoons. And in places where coyotes have moved in and they have displaced predators like red foxes, especially in the prairie potholes, this is shown that when coyotes come in and displace red foxes, nesting success of waterfowl increases because coyotes aren't near as effective nest predators as red foxes. Right.
Yeah.
So coyotes can have an impact of suppressing the predator that's most impacting the game bird that we're looking for.
I feel like the coyote has always been like that poor stepchild, just gets blamed for everything. It's got teeth.
Yeah. Yeah.
It gets canine. The blame.
He's got canines. To me, I almost like want to call it the prairie wolf, just because coyote is such a bad, like, it's a coyote. I'm going to shoot it. Yeah. And I'm like, I don't know. I don't know if we really – he does a lot of things. Like, to say he does all bad is not true.
That's completely false.
Yeah.
Completely false.
Yeah. From a game bird perspective – now, I'm not in the deer world like you guys tend to be more in, but from a game bird perspective, I would much rather have coyotes on the landscape in terms of if I'm going to raise more quail, I'd rather have coyotes on the landscape than red foxes, raccoons, possums, and skunks, right? Because while coyotes may catch a few adult quail, they're really not going to impact our nesting that much.
Mm-hmm.
Not near the impact that raccoons will. Raccoons will kill a few adults, but they're not going to kill a lot. But I would rather take my chances of having coyotes, more coyotes on the landscape than, say, red foxes and raccoons.
And not to say Man, that makes me happy to hear that. But if not to say that the coyotes don't need to be managed.
Right, no.
Because we've seen times where coyotes get overpopulated, mm-hmm. and they're running in a pack of 7 or 8, yep, and that's yep. when they can really start doing damage to a deer herd.
Mm-hmm.
So, sure, if you start seeing that on your landscape, that's when we encourage you. Maybe you need to do some trapping, mm-hmm. and knock those numbers down, because mm-hmm. it may be an entire family group that's running together, runs the whole territory, your farm, and it's like, ugh, that's a lot of stress. Or there's other coyotes or solitary animals or running a pair in pairs where you're like, they're not really doing anything. They're here, but they're not harassing the deer. They're just minding their own business, looking for rats or mice or
yep.
whatever else. So
yep.
it goes back to what we talked about, honestly, this morning and what you just talked about. It's very dangerous and I think irresponsible to talk in absolute terms. And like I said, to say that the coyote is all bad is irresponsible yeah. and it honestly just an uneducated statement.
Mm-hmm.
When we look at the greater ecosystem and get our minds out of like one focus for an animal and back our brains out a little bit, say, okay, this is the true view of how that animal affects the rest of the ecosystem.
And yep. opossum's another one, though. I mean, the amount of ticks that a possum eats off out of an area
mm-hmm.
Is not – he's not all bad. But at the same time, he eats a lot of eggs.
Yeah. See, I'm going to have to – and it's only from a personal standpoint because I'm a trapper. And I don't know yeah. how many traps I will have that will be clogged up with a wreck or a possum.
Yeah.
They are a nemesis to me on my trap line because yeah. if a possum's in it, then I can't catch a bobcat, right?
Yeah.
And so my thoughts, I'm really hard on possums. Kyle will laugh at me about that, but
you're an
right.
awesome possum trapper.
I can catch a possum.
But then again, you know, you think about, like, let's take the grasslands.
Yeah.
There wasn't a lot of big trees.
No.
So there wasn't a lot of possums
no.
on that landscape.
No.
There wasn't a lot of raccoons on that landscape. There was a lot of coyotes.
Yep.
And at one point, the wolves and grizzly bears.
Yep.
But
or if they were, they were concentrated to the river bottoms.
They were, yeah. yes.
And so that they didn't really predate on our game birds out on the prairie because they didn't have they were going to get killed by something else.
They weren't out there in the numbers that they are now, for sure. And so they didn't have the opportunity to find quail nests on these open grasslands. You're right. And that's exactly what we found with our quail study is there was less chance for these meso predators, so these raccoons or possums, to find quail nests because they weren't venturing out where the quail were nesting because they were in fear of getting caught by something, probably mm-hmm. a coyote. And it's important to note, too, when we talk about predators, and predators have always been something in the game bird world you want to kind of tiptoe around. We've kind of for a long time ignored predators as a problem. And I think that's a function of we don't want people to think, well, that's the silver bullet. Predators are the problem. Let's focus on them.
Mm-hmm.
When we want to get people focused on habitat first.
Yeah.
So I think we fear that if we talk about predators, people will grab onto that and forget about habitat. But that's not what we're talking about. But we can't ignore predators because mm-hmm. our research in Missouri is showing that raccoons are at densities that are 4 times greater than they were in 1980. So there's four times more raccoons.
How do they find that information?
So we do scent station surveys.
Mm-hmm.
So we put out scent, you know, stations.
Like
you know,
a trail camera survey
yep,
for deer.
Yep.
But scent station.
Yep. So sift some dirt, put a lure in there, and then come back the next day and count the tracks. And so that gives us an index.
Wow.
And we also have some information from our bow hunter survey that we've had going on in Missouri for a long time, where we have bow hunters record what they see.
Well, you know that's not all true then if you're interviewing deer
yeah.
hunters.
Yeah, yeah. yeah
I saw a coon. He had 16 stripes on his tail. I yeah. counted every single one.
He had 16 kits running behind.
Yeah, I don't count the deer hunter stuff. You know. But so we know these predators are going up. And that in itself is a problem. There's 4 times more raccoons from 1980. But think about the landscape in 1980. It was probably mm-hmm. a lot more friendly to quail than it is now.
Yeah.
So you got more coons on the landscape, yep. less quail habitat on the landscape, more pressure on these guys. And yeah. so we've got to deal with it somehow. Yeah. We've got to take steps that we can, whatever steps we can that are within the law, that are within something that we can control. And one of the things that we can do is manage against them with habitat.
Yeah. I'm glad you said that. That's exactly what I was thinking. Like, you can trap every day that it's legal, but you're still not getting to the root of the problem.
Right.
And the root of the problem is bad habitat.
Yep.
Or habitat that improves predator numbers. Bad habitat for the species quail that you're trying to promote.
Mm-hmm. One thing that I was thinking is, you know, when you talk about quail management, is you try to chain and make co-ops or cover a bigger area.
Mm-hmm.
So at the same time, you're trying to, like, link to an adjoining. You talked about it last week. Like, if you're looking for a piece of ground that has quail, how are we going to know there's some in the area? You're going to drive around, see if there's habitat in the area that may hold some quail, and then try to enhance the habitat to your farm to where you can create a highway, if you will, to tie them together.
Right.
Same is true. So if we're doing that, we're trying to do the same thing to where you have basically removed the trees or try to make the habitat the very best it can to link quail habitats together. But at the same time, you've got growing up trees, growing up hedgerows to where you're tying in raccoons and other habitat to other predator habitat or highways together.
Yep.
To where you're kind of getting, you're almost at the same time enhancing the population to create a highway for quail. You're eliminating a highway for the raccoon.
Yep.
That's what we're going for.
Yeah, right. What we saw with our raccoon movement, so we had GPS collars on these raccoons. We could see how they use the landscape. They use these linear features, so they would use these connecting corridors to go from one piece of property to another, and it may be a ditch, it may be a fence row, you know, whatever, but they were using these linear features. And so one of the things that we recommend is if you eliminate those, then you don't give them a pathway by which they could move. So then if you eliminate these connecting corridors, then you're not going to have very many raccoons. You're going to have to deal with the raccoons you've got on or the predators you've got on your place and not worry so much about getting more. So if you can get rid of those connecting corridors, at least you've gotten rid of the source population, say, then you can focus on what you've got. And that's important. And that may be, and that's going to involve working with your land, with your neighbors, right? Because it's hard to own enough ground to be able to do that all on one piece of property. So that's where these co-ops are working with your neighbors, you know, and talk to them and say, hey, do you mind if we come in and eliminate this tree row that connects my farm with yours so that we can, you know, reduce the highway here? And that's where partnerships and working with landowners is big.
I think it's funny. You know, we probably talked about on the podcast or just use that phrase, you know, farmers are eliminating all these trees and this and that, but it's not necessarily eliminating cover from that area. It's just manipulating it.
Yep.
If that's what, you know, we're not trying to like, okay, let's doze out this. That's not what that means. It's let's just make this a shrub, a woody.
Yes,
you know,
you're right. Yeah. If you think about what these quail need is they need these shrubby corridors, any of these shrubby habitats, and tall trees aren't doing anything for our quail. And so, but you can use them to your advantage. You can cut them down and be a start of your, of a down tree structure.
Sure.
You know, so drag them out into a field of native grass and it won't be long. There's birds that are defecating in it and you've got a shrub thicket growing up right there. And so you can use them to your advantage. We're not advocating, you know, getting dozing out trees and then just having a bare, you know, bare spot, putting back something in that's more appropriate for the species.
I got two questions. One, before the end of the podcast, I want you to talk about like the most memorable quail hunt you ever had. But before we get there, one of the things that we've talked about in the past, and I know, you know, having some bare ground, is super important into the habitat that's necessary for quail. Talk a little bit about that. And then, dormant season disking.
Okay.
And techniques that people can use on their land to create that type and why it's important.
Yeah. So bare ground is very important for quail. And bare ground is one of those things that when people hear it, it can invoke different images.
Mm-hmm.
Some people can think
point.
Bare ground and see a crop field in January. That's,
well, I do bare ground. Yeah. Every year we till our crops.
Yeah.
Yep, that's bare ground, but that's not what we're talking about. So what we're talking about is in a matrix of herbaceous habitat, having areas where there's no vegetation between vegetation clumps or mm-hmm. very, very little vegetation. So you've got a clump of blue stem and you've got a bare ground or you've got a few stalks of forbs that are growing and then another clump over here 3-4 feet away. That's the bare ground we're talking about. And what it does is it provides travel corridors.
It goes back to a little bit of like the umbrella structure
yes.
for the forb situation.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. So when these forbs kind of canopy out, mm-hmm. ragweed's a good one. Mm-hmm. Ragweed kind of grows, you know, where you have fresh disturbance.
Good is not the word I use with ragweed.
Oh, it's yeah. Yeah, it's great. Yeah. No, I love. In fact, I was looking for.
You're putting the ragweed on the pestle.
That's right.
I have been because of my experience in the Southeast. I've been looking for a source for common ragweed seed, and I know you can find.
We're
it.
We're gonna sell it. It's gonna be Lannan Legacy.
Do
Legacy
it.
Series.
Yeah, if you can do that, I would buy it. Because you know we can
step
we,
right up, step right
it,
up.
I mean, it is really good because it provides a great food source, but it provides such a beautiful canopy, mm-hmm. and umbrella effect.
If I was to ask you, because we get asked this question a lot from the deer side,
yep.
what's the best thing I can plant? Because we all want a simple fix. We all want a one-hit wonder. And so people, and I'll ask them, I'll say, well, what do you think? And maybe alfalfa, clover, or soybeans. That's the most common.
Yeah.
And I'll always say, you know, those are all non-native.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to take fertilizer and lime to get it to grow. I'm going to have to amend the soil. They don't really provide good cover. They provide some forage they provide great forage for your deer, but no cover. And the crude protein levels can be matched with common ragweed in most places, in a lot of places. So common ragweed, an annual, can grow up even 5-6 foot tall, I've seen mm-hmm. it. In bottom fields, it provides cover, provides great forage, but at the same time, it provides forage for birds, too.
Yep.
I have a hard time going away from, and it's native. It's common ragweed.
Yeah. Yeah, it's common, right?
So, and it goes from way, like, northeast all the way to kind of central Midwest or western Midwest.
Yeah.
And so it's like... And it's probably already in seed bank. A little bit of light dormant season disking, it's probably going to pop up.
Yep. You're right.
I'm asking you, from a quail standpoint, what is one of the best things you could plant?
Plant?
Like, if you're looking for the one-hit wonder that's like, woo.
I would love to have plant a stand of common ragweed. And I know it sounds like I'm trying to parallel what you're saying. But it's not. It's absolutely not. In fact, I have looked. I would like to have food plots of common ragweed. So food plots per se of common ragweed, because it's going to have max brood use. Broods are going to gravitate to ragweed, and then it's going to provide an excellent food source. I can't think of a better quail plant. There's other ragweeds too. Western ragweed is great, as is giant ragweed. Giant ragweed actually can serve as a surrogate for woody cover. Or thermal cover in some cases because it gets so big.
Yeah.
Now, I would probably, if I was going to plant one thing, I would want to establish some sort of grass because you've got to have nesting.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
But provided I have nesting cover, then I'm going to think ragweed. You know, it's great. When I see it show up in the public land that I manage, whether we disc for it or we graze our grasslands to get it to grow up, I really love it.
So, tying back to that question or that comment about disturbed ground,
mm-hmm.
Soil, exposed soil, what is the best practice to get that creation of scattered clumps of mm-hmm. grasses, forbs mixed in?
Mm-hmm.
With disturbed dirt, what is the best thing a person can do to create that?
Okay, so before I answer that, I want to talk about the importance of disturbed ground real quick.
Okay.
You mentioned that in our quail study that we've done, and we model all these quail locations, so we know where all these quail are because we had radio telemetry. The number one factor that drove where quail were going to be found was disturbance within the last year. If it was disturbed within the last year, quail were going to use it. If it wasn't disturbed within the last year, quail tended to avoid it. That's how critical disturbance was. We're talking about disturbance with grazing or fire or disking. That's disturbance. It could have been any one of those or a combination. If I had the ability to graze, that's the disturbance that I would use the most, would be grazing, because you get reduction, you get removal of plant matter, so you get a reduction in your density of the forage that's there or the herbaceous vegetation that's there, which is going to facilitate quail movement. But you also get bare ground because of hoof action. Fire is a great disturbance. The problem is you tend to get a limited amount of time because it comes through, it removes the vegetation layer, but it doesn't disturb the ground. Disking is another great one. So a dormant season disking where you come in, take a stand of grass, and you just run a light pass over it, or even a heavier pass on some of this real, thick-rooted native grasses, run a heavy pass of a disc over it or a plow, really turn it up. And you need to be careful, because I will say this. In some places, I know Kyle fights this on some of the land that he manages. If he puts a disc in the ground and turns it over, he's going to get Johnson grass or Sericea. So you need to kind of be careful with that.
Certainly.
Don't go whole hog and do it. And then like, oh, no, what have I done?
You
kind of do
test.
Yeah, got to do a test. And if your test shows up, you're going to get ragweed as a response, man, just keep going. Mm-hmm. But that grazing number one, and then any kind of other disturbance would be right after that.
I'm going to have a little comment on that too, because we see this from the from the deer side of the world. People, somebody told us this, so we won't take credit for it. But by golly, we're going to use the heck out of it. Mm-hmm. Analysis paralysis.
Yep.
To where a lot of people don't cut trees because they're worried of an invasive growing up.
Mm-hmm.
But they'll stare through 200 yards of closed canopy, open park setting forest for the fear that an invasive might show up.
Yep.
So I would, we
or,
always
or
try
fear
to tell
of
them.
Cutting the wrong tree.
We would, yes. We would rather them cut it and then deal with the invasive rather than not do anything at all. So at my farm, I'm going to say there's probably Sericea that might come up, but I'll address that issue next. Mm-hmm. I don't want to not disturb because I don't want the fear of invasive keep me from doing that.
Yeah. No.
So, the presence of quail outweighs the possibility or likelihood of a potential
I can take care of Johnson grass and Sericea. I know what herbicide to use. Mm-hmm. I know what I'm going to do. I'll fix that problem.
Yep.
But I'm not going to not do my management.
Practice. There's not a lot that we don't have an answer for out there in terms of being able to fix it, whether it's Sericea or Johnson grass or fescue or some other kind of invasive that may pop up, at least now.
I put out questions on our Instagram page or asked something to see if anybody had any questions for you. Has anyone ever done the study of, because in my head I'm picturing, because we saw this a little bit in Oklahoma. So we talk about grazing native warm season grasses a lot during the summer months, obviously, while it's growing. But to create more forbs in our prairies or in our grasslands, our native pastures, is the application I'm talking about. We would do dormant season disking. Mm-hmm. What about, and it wouldn't be a lot, you wouldn't get a lot of grazing opportunities, but what if a person went in and tried to graze native worms, and I say this native worm season a little bit loosely because I would like to encourage cool seasons like some of our native cool season rye and rushes and sedges in some of the wet areas to where we could graze those during the fall months while the warm season grass is so tall and let's say rank that they probably wouldn't selectively graze those as much or mm-hmm. at first. And so you get that disturbance to kind of recreate dormant season disking, and you would possibly get this flush of ragweed in between clumps of big native yeah. grass. To me, I feel like that would be amazing, but I don't know if anybody – that's a practice where you're like – it's almost like you're – I don't know. Yeah. You're trying something I don't know if I've ever heard anybody talk about.
Yeah, there's been so much work done on grazing that it's possible that it's been done.
Yeah.
I don't know it off the top of my head. It makes sense if you're disturbing the ground at that time of the year with a hoof
yeah.
or with a plow, you should get the same – or you should get a similar response. Plus, with the hoof, you're putting nutrients back into the soil, incorporating feces and urine that you wouldn't be with a plow. So it would probably have
great
some
point.
Benefits.
That's a good
I just
point.
Don't know that. I just don't know off the top of my head.
Since
if that
grazing
work
and
done.
Quail are so
there's a lot of synergies between them.
And well, it just started. I think like more people are trying to tie the two together yep. in the last 10 years
yeah,
than before.
Right.
So I don't know if I've ever seen that, but it's something I want to try.
Yeah.
I mean, in a perfect world of me, I've got completely native cool season pastures, completely native warm season, a little bit in between,
mm-hmm.
but at the same time,
mm-hmm.
that's a dreaming big.
Yeah, there's a lot of work to be done with the grazing aspect and quail management, particularly in the non-rangeland states, so states from the Kansas border east, right? Those are
yep.
those are kind of the non-rangeland states. From Kansas west, you get into more range management. Here, we're more of a agronomy pastures type stuff.
Yeah, gotcha. No. I definitely
favorite quail hunt.
Okay,
ever. Most memorable.
Man, so you mentioned that, and I've been trying to, answer your questions and have that in the back of my mind too.
Just been throwing curveballs at you.
Okay, so. I'm going to be kind of equivocal here and not give you one here,
yeah.
right? Any quail hunt with my family has been – it's probably what I would put right up there. I grew up quail hunting with my father. So we would quail hunt together. I'm an only child, so, you know, he and I would go out together. And I can remember distinctly the first quail I killed. I shot that year. The last day of quail season, I killed my first quail. I was so excited. The next year,
what kind of gun did you use?
I used a 20 gauge.
Okay.
A Remington 1100 20 gauge at first.
Yeah.
And then, so the next year, I was pumped. I was like, I've got this quail hunting figured out. I killed a quail on the last day of season. And I remember that year, shot. Got so frustrated. And finally, on the last day of that season, I killed another quail. But by the third season, I'd kind of gotten where I can hit them. But this year, my son, Caleb, killed his first quail. And we were hunting public land in Missouri. And he killed his first quail. And that was great. We had hunted all morning and hadn't seen much. The dogs pointed a covey. Caleb went up and he shot. The only quail that came his way, he shot it and he killed it on his first shot. And I
wow.
was super stoked. He had just got... that gun for Christmas, and he was so excited. So that was memorable for my father, you know, as a father to see that.
Yeah.
So anytime you have those memories, one of my favorite hunts, in terms of, you know, when you go hunting, you want to be successful, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm not to that phase of hunting yet where I'm like, well, the experience was great. I just got to go out and see the dog work. Maybe I'll get there, but I'm not there yet. I want to kill stuff, right?
Yeah.
I want the dogs to find birds. I want to kill stuff. So this year, Kyle Hedges and I hunted some prairies that he manages one day in Dade County. And we each got a limit before noon. And it was a great day. Dogs pointed great. Shooting was great. Bird numbers were good. So that was super memorable. That was more recent. But
yeah.
Yeah, any time where you can go out with my family, especially now that my son's old enough to do it, that's
mm-hmm.
I'm really looking forward to future hunts with him. He's already said, "Hey,
right.
Dad, let's go prairie chicken hunting next year." Okay, yeah,
twist my arm, why don't
yeah.
you?
Yeah, let's do that. So, yeah.
What it doesn't matter about species, but just a location or an area that you're just in love with when it comes to upland bird hunting, that like scenery, you're like, gosh, I just love
that's
it
easy.
Here.
So it's northern Montana. Northern Montana. So in 2006, I was able
Let's go. You got me.
Look, we were hunting right off the Milk River. If so, for the deer world, that's a big one.
Wait, you drove to the Milk River to chase a bird?
you don't know how many weird looks that we got from some of the landowners that we knocked on the door. Say, you want to hunt what? You came up here, and they would look at our tail. You're from Missouri, and you want to, okay, you know, have at it. So Montana has a big bird hunting.
That sounds like fun.
Yeah, I mean, it was great. So Montana has a big bird hunting culture in terms of out-of-state folks. But a lot of them go to the northeast part of Montana. And I think they're coming from the Midwest or the East, and they drive hour after hour after hour, and they finally get to Montana. We're here, the promised land. Bam, let's start hunting. Montana is a huge state.
Huge.
So we went to the north central part of Montana. So this was past almost to the foothills of the Rockies. So, and the reason is I wanted to hunt sharptails, Hungarian partridge, and sage grouse. And that was the area where the research that I'd done showed that we could have the most success at harvesting those three. So did that 2 years in a row, 2006 and 2007, and hunted sharptails and gray partridge or Hungarian partridge. And we would find them in the same habitat. Mm-hmm. And then we went down into the sage flats and hunted mm-hmm. sage grouse, which since I was a kid, I was always enamored with pronghorn and sage grouse. For some reason, I'd always wanted to hunt sage grouse. And so that was great. I mean, you've got a bird that's, you know, the adult males are 7 pounds, mm-hmm. right, when they jump up in front of you. It's just a huge... And the landscapes are beautiful. You've got mountains in the background. You've got these big rolling hills. It was the best hunt I've ever been on in terms of the scenery, in terms of hunting the species that I wanted to hunt, in terms of bird numbers. Then the bird numbers were really good. And, you know, they fluctuate over time based on weather conditions and mm-hmm. habitat loss. But, man, that landscape up there is just phenomenal.
Did you go up there to hunt public ground or private? And basically, did you have a plan?
Yeah, we had a plan.
Okay.
So Montana has got a program called Block Management. And so it's mm-hmm. basically walk-in hunting.
Yep.
They lease land from landowners. Yep. And there's a couple of different kinds. Some of them you just show up and hunt, and you kind of sign your name in the book. Some of them you got to contact the landowner beforehand, get written permission. So I had a plan of some certain block management areas that I wanted to hunt. And then when we got there... Then you start hunting those areas, and then you see birds on other land or say, hey, that looks good. And then you start knocking on doors. And doors are few and far between there. It's not yeah. like, I mean, it's
out there.
It's out there. And so you might knock on a door and the guy give you permission to hunt, but he'll have a few to several hundred acres of land to hunt. And this was, and so we tried to, We tried to time it before pheasant season because I pheasant hunt in Kansas and I really didn't care about driving all the way out there to shoot mm-hmm. pheasants. And so that limited the number of hunters that were already out there because the locals like to hunt pheasants a lot. And we didn't really have any trouble getting permission. Of course, and I say that this was 2006. So this was over a decade ago and I haven't been able to go back for various reasons. So, you know, dynamics change. But at least then, getting permission to hunt on some public or private land, if you could find the landowner, wasn't all that difficult if you wanted to hunt upland birds. Now, if I was out there to hunt pronghorn or mule deer, probably a different story because mm-hmm. that's what drives a lot of that, the income of some of those landowners.
Think of a guy that just came from Montana, big cattle farmer, but up in that native mm-hmm. region. That
yeah, around gonna have to Grand... I won't say Grand Rapids, but my Grand,
yeah.
Something
who knows?
Up there.
We're
going
to work on it.
We were in north central Nebraska from between Malta and Havre is where we were at, way up. We were hunting not far from Canada, really.
So I got a few questions for you here on our Instagram page.
live. This is about as live recording all right. as you can get.
So all I'm right. going to record you giving the answer.
Okay.
You've got, I think, a 30-second minimum to
Great
answer.
Great Falls was where he was at.
Great Falls. Okay, so that's south of where we were hunting, yeah.
Gotcha. So most important thing for quail management. I know it's kind of vague.
Is usable space.
Okay, so I'll here we go. I'm gonna share the response for you. So here we go. So go ahead.
Okay, so the most important thing for quail management is usable space. And usable space is sort of the foundation of quail management. It's providing habitat that is usable throughout the year. And when we're talking about usable, we got to have herbaceous cover in terms of grasses and forbs. You got to have shrubby cover, and you got to have bare ground. The only way we're going to see meaningful, profound increases in quail numbers across the country or across an area where you're interested is by increasing the amount of usable space in that area. It's key.
Okay. I like it.
Yep.
Next one, any way to make a forest more productive for quail? So,
timber harvest first.
Hold on. Here we go.
Yeah. Timber harvest, reducing the density, reducing the basal area first. It's typically better to do that slower, kind of on a slow process, but reducing that basal area and then reintroducing prescribed fire after that.
Perfect.
Very good. I know that one. That one's definitely like my brother works for the U.S. Forest mm-hmm. Service now, and he talks a lot about when they'll have like wildfires go out and it'll rock, just rip through some mm-hmm. hardwoods and it'll kill some trees.
Mm-hmm.
He said, and then you've got an explosion of natives and they'll go back like they may work a fire 2 years later and go in there and Atlanta and be like, oh, there's a ton of quail around here now. And it's just because there's pockets
yep.
where the fire got super hot,
yep.
killed a bunch of trees,
yep.
a lot of young forest coming back. So yep. you get that shrubby effect,
yep.
a lot of natives.
Yep.
It's like, okay, number one thing, I'm going to burn the heck out of my woods.
yeah. Yep. Yeah, reduce that basal area is key.
And what you mean by that, just translating, is allowing sunlight yep. in.
Allowing sunlight. And there's been quite a bit of work done in looking at quail response to forest management. And quail will respond to forest management, any kind of forest management you do that opens up the ground and gets sunlight. But the key to seeing really sustainable and good numbers is to really get that basal area down
mm-hmm.
to the 30, you know, 30 basal area or so. So where you're getting kind of open woodlands into savanna stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Not saying quail can't use above because they will, but if you want to really see good numbers, get it down to that.
And yep. that burning, reintroduced prescribed fire, brings back into that setting the bare dirt aspect.
Absolutely.
And then you
yeah.
get your annual weeds on top of the shrubs and grasses and things.
Yeah.
It's very dynamic.
Yeah. Yep. Yep.
You kind of already answered this, but favorite state for quail hunting?
My favorite state is Kansas.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, of the states that I've hunted, that's my favorite state. Now, I would love to go to Texas on a boom year. This year was not the year to go, but I would love to go to Texas on a boom year. I would love to hunt the other species of quail.
Hmm.
We haven't talked about scaled quail,
yep.
Gamble's quail, Valley quail, Mearns quail. I would love to go to the Southwest. That's
yep.
that's the next trip Kyle and I are talking about doing is to – Now, you've got to really time weather because those quail are rainfall dependent. And so if you can time a good weather year, I would love to go down there. There's abundance of public land, and if you can get a good rain year, your quail numbers are very good.
So any listeners in the Southwest
yeah.
part
yeah.
of the
– New Mexico, Arizona, I mean, call me.
Yeah.
call you in touch
us.
With Frank.
Yes,
yeah.
yes.
call, we'll pass on the word.
Call
wink,
them
wink,
first.
Nod.
Definitely
yeah.
call
yeah.
them first.
You know how people really are watching like draw units and tags and all these points. Frank and Kyle are sitting there monitoring rainfall in all these other states, and when they just get the rainfall, they're over the counter tag, I'm bored, baby.
Probably in north central
or
Montana, you're looking at snow
yes.
in the winter. Yeah.
Yeah, you're looking at severity. You're looking at snow and so winter severity, you're looking at drought because they can be very dry out there. So if you that's been the problem the last few years. They've been suffering from a drought,
mm-hmm.
and so reproduction has been pretty poor. So I wouldn't have gone. I didn't. But if I had the opportunity, I wouldn't have gone to Nebraska the last, or excuse me, Montana the last two or three years, because of drought. Now they've got a good snowpack this year. If it's not too hard for of a winter, it may mean that there's going to be a flush,
good flush of birds.
Yeah, a good flush of birds. But they're starting out with a fairly low number.
Yeah,
you know, going into
you'd
it.
You'd like so to see at that point a couple of years.
Yes,
of great weather.
Bingo. Here we go. But what's interesting, and so when you think about quail in the Southwest, the El Nino cycle plays a big role. So quail abundances in Texas are typically correlated with an El Nino year, which we're coming into, which we have. And so Texans are really having a rough time this year because quail numbers are really in the tank. There's an El Nino coming. Could be more winter rains and quail.
Saturday Night Live listeners out there from way back, El Nino, which means the Nino.
The Nino.
Yeah. Yeah.
So El Nino, so looking to have probably more rainfall in Texas.
More
which
rainfall
would,
in the Southwest,
and,
which.
And you said you got the hook up.
We got
the
hook up.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Don't tease me.
I'm not teasing.
I'm telling you. Yeah.
We already got the invite to turkey hunt.
Oh, don't tease me that either. let me tell you a story.
We're moving to Texas.
Let me tell you a story, and you may not believe this. When I got into this field, I wanted to be a turkey biologist.
Yeah?
I did. I grew up turkey hunting, you know, in the spring. I absolutely loved it. I wanted to be a turkey biologist. And then for some reason, I started to work with, you know, smaller game birds, quail and prairie chickens, and I just got, you know,
infatuated
with that. It's a great word, with quail and prairie grouse, and you know, still love to turkey hunt, but I'm glad what I'm doing.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. All right, last question.
Okay,
number one quail predator.
Oh,
it's a loaded question.
Wow,
that's a good one.
They just
number
threw
one
that out there.
Number one quail predator. It depends on the season, right?
Great point.
I would say if I was going to be in the total year, if you take adult quail.
I'm going to do this again for you.
Okay.
Because I threw that off there. Go ahead.
Okay, so it would matter what season you're in. But if you took the annual life cycle of a quail, if it lived, you know, a quail population, and you had a pie chart, I would tend to say be more raptors than mammals. Raptors are going to take more quail than mammals. But they're both going to be pretty high. Now, nesting, snakes, you know. Raccoons, possum skunks, armadillos, anything will depredate a nest. Well, I say anything, not anything will, but a lot of things will depredate a nest.
And that's just easy pickings.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, that's
right.
That's
right.
That's too easy to pass on.
And a lot of things will catch young quail because they're fairly immobile and they're fairly helpless.
Yeah.
Yep.
Crazy, crazy good podcast. Again, loving it, man. And I think a lot of listeners, though, are too.
I hope so.
I hope more and more people are going to get used to hearing you and Kyle come in on the podcast and share some knowledge or research. And I mean, we haven't even touched on prairie chickens or.
Oh, yeah. So there's a lot about population dynamics and the theory of quail management that we haven't even scratched the surface.
All the research stuff that we talk about behind the scenes.
The article you sent us.
Yes. Yes, yeah. That's it.
There's more to come.
Yeah.
And for the deer guys that are going, oh, my gosh, another one about quail, all this stuff helps the deer as well.
Yeah.
Like, if you make the best, I'd say this, if you make, and it's not an absolute, but if you took a farm and you made it the very best habitat for quail, pretty good chance it's the best habitat for deer in that neighborhood.
Let's
just go back to the raccoon. You're cutting these den trees down, basically, top them off. Raccoons predate and have the potential to of fawns too. I mean, we're talking the same thing here.
We're just
if you will, and it's not all, you know, transferable, but quail and deer, like, a lot of similarities here.
They're native species that, you know, that early successional habitat is critically important to their life cycle.
You got it.
Right. Hopefully everybody enjoyed it. Once again, if you have questions for Frank or Kyle, Kyle's been subbing out the last two. But
Kyle's in New York City.
Kyle's in New York City right now, today.
He's about the, like, I picture
least
him in
person.
New York City, like,
oh,
Crocodile Dundee in New York City.
You know, that is a perfect analogy that I never thought of. will probably look at him there like they did at Crocodile Dundee.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And he's going to stick his head out of the hotel and say, it's for your behind or whatever he says whenever he's looking at the toilet.
Yeah. He sent me a picture. He wore his quail hat to New York and he sent me a picture. He said, I'm the only one here with a quail hat. Well, duh.
I could have told you that.
But he wearing it as a badge of honor.
That's right. Yeah. As a duty.
All right. Well, everybody, hopefully you enjoyed it. info@atlantalegacy.tv. Please leave us a review on iTunes or our Facebook page. And check us out there for any upcoming events. I know Matt is going to be in Ohio this weekend.
This coming Saturday.
And then we've got an event, of course, Deer Steward 2 course in Ohio, Gallipolis in September.
Yep.
So check that out. Finish up your Deer Steward 1. And so you can be there. And we'll catch you next week.
See ya.